This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. When President Obama signed a bill to reopen the federal government after the shutdown in October, it wasn't designed as a permanent fix. The bill will keep the government open through January 15th and the federal borrowing authority safe until February 7th. There are currently 29 House and Senate members working together to produce a compromise budget by Friday, December 13th. They are led in this effort by Paul Ryan and Patty Murray, the respective chairs of the House and Senate budget committees.
We're going back to regular order. This is the budget process. The House passes a budget, the Senate passes a budget, you come together to try and reconcile the differences. That's the way we're supposed to do things.
Chairman Ryan knows I'm not going to vote for his budget. I know that he's not going to vote for mine. We're going to find the common ground between our two budgets that we both can vote on, and that's our goal.
One of the senators working to find common ground on that committee is Vermont's Bernie Sanders. Last week, he released his own progressive budget, and he joins us today to talk about that and to talk about the compromise budget he's working on. Senator Sanders, nice to have you back on the program.
Good to be with you, Jane.
What's the latest on this committee's progress?
Well, there are a lot of discussions going on, some private, some public. I think we start off, as Senator Murray indicated in her statement, with very, very different budgets. What I believe and what the Senate committee budget was about is saying that we are not going to cut Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we are going to ask the wealthiest people in this country and largest corporations to start paying their fair share of taxes by ending some outrageous loopholes. But in other words, we're not going to balance the budget on the backs of some of the most vulnerable people in this country. And just interestingly, yesterday a poll came out which very much supported the Senate position and not the Republican House position. And by overwhelming numbers, what the American people are saying, at a time when the wealthy and largest corporations are doing extremely well, they have got to play a greater role in deficit reduction. And there's also very, very strong support from the American people not to cut Social Security and Medicare.
We just heard from Patty Murray, though, saying, look, Chairman Ryan is not going to vote for my budget. I'm not going to vote for his. So where's the room for compromise?
Well, there is. And here's there are two points that I would make which make me cautiously optimistic about this process. Number one, at the meetings that I have been with my Republican colleagues, they are very, very aware that the government shutdown and the threat for the first time in the history of this country not to pay our bills did not work particularly well for them. And over again, I heard my Republican colleagues saying, we do not want another government shutdown. And that's great, because I think that's something that all of us should not want. That was just a terrible thing, and we don't want that to be repeated. The second area where I'm beginning to see some grounds for a compromise is you hear Republicans talking about, quote-unquote, tax expenditures. And that's a fancy word for tax loopholes. They understand, as I do, that it makes no sense that this government is losing about $100 billion every single year because large and profitable corporations are stashing their profits in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, and other tax havens and not paying, in some cases, a nickel in federal taxes. You have the situation today where about one out of four corporations in America pay zero in federal taxes. They understand that doesn't make sense. Now, what they would like to do is to say, okay, let's address that problem, but let's use the revenue that we capture to lower corporate tax rates. That's what they want to do with it. What we are saying is, no, let's capture that revenue to do two major things. Number one, invest in the American economy so that we can create the millions of jobs we desperately need. Because, Jane, when you ask the American people what their major domestic concern is, they say, yeah, deficit is important. But what they say is far more important is the fact that unemployment is much too high. The youth unemployment is close to 20%, and they want us to create jobs. And I agree with that. So we want to use some of that money to invest in our crumbling infrastructure, into energy efficiency, and start creating the jobs that we desperately need. Second of all, some of that money should be used toward deficit reduction. We have cut the deficit in half in the last 4 years, from $1.4 trillion to $700 billion. We should do more. And thirdly, I think it is appropriate that we take a judicious look, careful look at the tax rates the corporations are paying and make some adjustments. So that's where I think, Jane, the opportunity is for a compromise. Both sides recognize that giving huge tax breaks and allowing loopholes to exist for very profitable corporations doesn't make sense. The disagreement is how you spend that revenue and what you do with that revenue, and I think there is a ground for a compromise there.
Well, and in fact, in your own plan, your progressive budget, stopping corporations from using offshore tax havens is one of the main points that you want to make. So it's just a matter of what then you would do with that money.
Exactly. But, you know, if you and I agree that we can capture X amount of money and the disagreement is how you utilize that money, you are close to a compromise. You're talking the same language, and the difference is how you spend the money. So I am cautiously optimistic that we can make some progress in that area.
Well, if you can find a compromise on something like that, that's one thing. But what about compromises on things like cuts to Social Security?
I think the American people have made it very, very clear in overwhelming numbers, Jane, that they understand that in this very volatile economy, that at a time when poverty among seniors is growing higher, that when many people are just hanging on, that cutting this lifeline does not make a whole lot of sense. And what I should also tell you is that the argument that Social Security is going broke, which you'll see on Fox TV 8 times a night, just is not true. Social Security has a $2.7 trillion surplus and can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for close to the next 20 years. So it is not going broke. It needs to be adjusted. And my thought is that if we want to make Social Security strong for our kids and our grandchildren, the way you do that is end the cap on taxable income. Right now, if you're making $10 million a year, and I'm making $113,000 a year, we both contribute the same amount into the Social Security. Trust me, what Barack Obama talked about when he ran in 2008 is lift that cap, start at $250,000. You will bring in enough revenue to keep Social Security strong for between 50 and 75 years. I think that makes a lot of sense. The American people understand that Social Security has been the most successful federal program in the modern history of America, gone a long way to lowering senior poverty, helping people with disabilities, helping widows and orphans, and I am not supportive of cutting Social Security.
Well, I know how strongly you feel about that, but are you likely to be able to persuade Paul Ryan and Republicans in the House to your side?
Well, I would say, Jane, that Paul Ryan reads the same polls that I do.
Right, but we all read the polls as well about how much the U.S. population did not want the government shut down, and yet it still happened. It's not necessarily true that whatever the people want, the legislators in Washington are going to go for.
That is, underline that several times. That is absolutely the case. But when you have in a recent poll 67% of the people opposing cuts in Social Security, you're not hearing the Republicans. They use the term entitlements and so forth and so on. My own guess is that we're not going to cut Social Security. We're not going to cut Medicare. I'm not going to cut Medicaid. That's because a number of us feel very strongly that that makes no sense at all in terms of public policy and what it would do to so many vulnerable seniors and others who are out there. And by the way, when you talk about the so-called chain PI, and now I speak as chairman of the Veterans Committee, it will mean very significant cuts to disabled veterans. So it's one thing for some pundits to get up there and say, well, you know, let's look at entitlement reform. Entitlement reform is a fancy term meaning cuts to Social Security and Medicare. But when it comes back in real life to real people, the American people don't want that. Last point I would make on this issue, Jane, which is an important point. You will recall, as I hope many of the listeners recall, that when Bill Clinton left office in 2001 and President Bush took over, this country was running a $236 billion surplus. That's a large surplus. And the economists were projecting that that surplus would just grow in years to come. The reason we went into a significant deficit are the following. Number one, President Bush took us into wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and forgot to pay for those wars. The war in Iraq alone will cost more than $3 trillion by the time we take care of the last veteran. Number two, we gave, during the middle of wars, huge tax breaks, $1 trillion of which went to the wealthiest 2%. Congress passed a Medicare Part D prescription drug program, over $400 billion, not paid for. And then we had the Wall Street crash, which resulted in significant less revenue coming in. And I think most Americans say, why are you cutting Social Security, which doesn't contribute to the deficit, which is strong for 20 years, because we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and forgot to pay for it. So I don't think there's a whole lot of support, frankly, for cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I think there is a lot of support in this country and even among Republicans for taking a hard look at these corporate loopholes and ending them.
I'm talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders about his vision of a good federal budget. He's on a bipartisan congressional committee trying to come up with a compromise to avoid a future government shutdown and pass a budget. But he's also released his own vision of a progressive budget for the country. Listeners, if you have questions for him, you can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Senator Sanders, any way, though, that you and this committee are going to be able to make a deal by the self-imposed December 13th deadline?
Well, it'll probably be December 12th at midnight. That's what usually happens around here. And what people should understand is that these negotiations, you know, there's a lot of bluffing that's going on, and Republicans saying, absolutely, no revenue, no revenue, no revenue. But I'm not so sure that at the end of the day they are prepared to continue to defend huge loopholes that corporations now exist. So,
right, but you've said that in fact, in that case, you think there is room for compromise, but that's not the only kind of revenue that's on the table or that the Democrats would like to see changes to.
There are other ways that you could raise revenue, but I think for the Republicans – that is the easiest, and it's a strong and fair way to do it, because in a sense what they are saying is, look, we're not raising tax rates. We're not really raising taxes, which is their mantra, but we are doing away with the loophole. So I think it's easier for them to defend, and in fact it is good public policy.
Right, sure. So that we may be able to say, absolutely, there could be a compromise, leaving that aside. You know, changes like the one that you'd like to make to Social Security to lift the cap. That kind of issue seems like, in terms of revenue, it may be a harder sell.
That would be, for Republicans, a harder sell, yes.
So that's probably not going to happen? Can we say that's basically off the table for this budget?
Probably. I won't say, you know, strange things happen around here. But it's not impossible. You have some brave Republicans who say, yeah, you know what, Social Security is very important, and I don't want to cut it, and I don't want to cut benefits for disabled vets. And it is appropriate for the wealthiest people to pay a little bit more in taxes. Would I hold my breath that that will happen? Probably not.
So you're willing to leave that aside for now to reach a compromise?
Well, the fight that we're in right now, Jane, is, and I want to just tell you how difficult the pressure is. You mentioned a moment ago in passing that Congress does not always do what the American people want, and that is clearly a significant understatement. What I'm suggesting to you, and this is not just Bernie Sanders, I'm just telling you every poll that I have seen, and this runs across the board. It's Democrats, it's independents, it's Republicans. People do not want cuts in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Over and over again, people say, yup, the wealthy and large corporations should stop paying their fair share. That's the best way to deal with the problems of our budget. So that's what people are saying. But very often what you hear in Capitol Hill is something very, very different. So my own guess is you're not going to see cuts in Social Security. That Congress will, in fact, end up doing what the American people want. Whether we will go further and do what I want to do and make Social Security strong, not just for 20 years, but 50 or 60 years, that's a fight that will continue.
And probably at another time, it sounds like. Let's
yes.
go to Steve.
I think it's a victory right now if we can
just prevent
the effort to cut. Yes.
Let's go to Steve, who's calling in for you from Brattleboro. Hi, Steve. Go ahead.
Hi. Senator, I want to thank you for everything you're doing. I just had a quick question about the NSA budget. My understanding is it's a black hole. I mean, they're doing all this kind of surveillance stuff and so on. But to me, the issue is they're doing everything because they have a huge pot of money. They have lots of contractors and so on. And I wonder whether actually whether the budget is open, whether people in the Senate know how much money they're spending, and whether there's room for cuts in the NSA budget, which are connected to a whole other issues about what the U.S. is about and the Constitution of Freedom. But the size of the NSA budget, how big is it, and can you have an impact on it?
Senator Sanders, budget cuts to the National Security Agency.
I think I agree with everything that Steve just said. Now, I don't want to misspeak here. It's ostensibly secret, but I think the Washington Post keeps reporting, and I just don't remember what the number is. $50 billion comes to my mind, but I won't swear to that. It is a huge budget, and I think it is – before we even get into the budget of the NSA, let me be very clear. I happen to think that that agency is out of control right now. I think the idea that every telephone call that we make in America is filed someplace. I think the fact that they have used excuses to be able to get into emails of American citizens is not acceptable. Getting into the websites that we visit is not acceptable. In fact, I'm thinking we're going to be doing a town meeting probably in January and bringing in some leading national authorities on this issue. But I am very, very worried about the overreach, not only of the NSA, but other intelligence agencies. Terrorism is a serious issue. As you and I speak, there are people out there who are plotting against the United States who want to do us harm. But I absolutely believe that we can protect the American people in a constitutional manner and not give a blank check to the intelligence agencies, including the NSA. I think Steve makes a good point.
Have you changed your tune at all on your position on Edward Snowden and the revelations that he has caused to become public that are actually letting, in many cases, letting the American public and Congress know about some of the surveillance techniques being used?
No, my view is the same. And I think, you know, Snowden knew what he was doing. And what he did is violated an oath. That's what he did. He lied. But he did that because he thought what he was doing was in the best interest of the people of this country. I think he was.
But you don't see him as a whistleblower.
Well, I think ultimately, if he comes back and if he gets tried with a crime and if he goes to court, that's something that a court will have to balance. But I think there's no question that the revelations that he provided us and other countries is, in fact, causing a whole lot of discussion and is making us aware of the degree of Big Brother in the United States. I would just add to that one other point that we learned is the idea that the United States is spying on allies, whether it's Germany or many other countries, has been a disaster in terms of our foreign relations. If you are in a country where suddenly you find that your government is being spied on, it is hard to imagine that there's going to be enthusiasm in trying to work with the United States to combat the terribly important issues facing our planet, whether it's global warming or the global economy or whatever it is. So, you know, bottom line here for me, Jane, is huge overreach on the part of the intelligence agencies, and we've got to bring them back to the real world.
I'm talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders. We're talking about a good federal budget and what he thinks should be in a budget, as well as where the room for compromise is and what's in his progressive budget. We're also hearing from some of you on fiscal issues. You can give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. I'm talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders about budget priorities in Congress. If you have a question for him, you can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Bob. Go ahead.
Hi, Bernie. Keep up the good work for us.
Thanks, Bob.
We have coming up January 1st a Social Security cost of living raise. And there needs to be some kind of federal formula or calculation because as soon as that cost of living raise hits, almost immediately the state is going to take away that much or a greater amount from those of us who also get food stamps. So there is no cost of living raise for many Vermonters who are on Social Security and food stamps. When the federal goes up, the state goes down, and we lose.
All right, Bob, thanks very much for your comments. Senator Sanders, you want to reply?
Well, let me amplify on Bob's point, and I think he's absolutely right. This year, the cost of living increase, the COLA for Social Security beneficiaries and veterans, will be 1.5%. At the exact same time as you have virtually every Republican, some Democrats, and the president talking about a so-called chain CPI.
And that's the consumer price index, chain CPI.
Exactly, right. And the theory of this, Jane, is they are arguing that the current COLAs are, quote, unquote, too generous.
COLAs, of course, being the cost of living adjustment.
Right. Thank you for the translation. You're right. They are arguing those people who want to cut Social Security are saying, well, this 1.5% is too generous. And then they're going through a whole long song and a dance as to why they think the way we formulate COLAs are too generous right now. Well, I think if you go to any senior, not any senior, but most of the seniors in the state of Vermont, you say that, and I have. You know what they do? They laugh. I go to meetings and I say, well, people think that the COLAs that you're giving, the cost of living adjustments that you're getting, are too generous. And people actually laugh. And this year it's a 1.5%. Now, the problem here, we've worked on this issue. This is a tough issue to get to pass. I would argue and have introduced legislation to make this happen, that in fact the way we formulate cost of living adjustments for seniors is not only not too generous, it is too skimpy. It is not generous enough because right now seniors, in determining what a COLA is, are lumped in with kids who are 18 or 16 whose purchasing habits and needs are very different than seniors. So if you are 18 and you're buying an iPad or an iPod or a video game or a flat screen TV, the truth is those prices may well have gone down, or a computer, gone down in recent years. So for those purchases, the cost of living has gone down. But if you're a senior buying prescription drugs or trying to heat your home or buying food or buying health care, the likelihood is those costs have gone up.
Although some food costs have gone down and some fuel costs have gone down from last year.
Yes, they have. Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, this is complicated stuff. But in general, areas like prescription drugs and health care in recent years, although we're seeing some leveling off, and fortunately, in health care. But over the years, those areas have gone up a lot faster than general inflation. And those are the areas that seniors spend most of their money. So we think there should be a segregated index for seniors whose purchasing needs are different than the general public. And I think if you do that, you will find that seniors would probably get a higher cost of living adjustment rather than, as the proponents of a chain CPI want, a lower.
Let's go to Charlie in Burlington. Hi, Charlie. Go ahead.
Hey, how's it going? Senator, I just want to say that you are one of the only elected members of Congress who seems to know what he's talking about and seems informed and has real conviction. So I definitely thank you for that and appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
I wanted to talk about the military budget and your thoughts on, obviously, it's a third of our federal budget. And I wanted to see your thoughts on that and see, if we could somehow cut that money and maybe allocate it to veterans who have served us, and kind of see what else we could do, with the billions and billions and trillions of dollars that we're pouring into defense and military budget.
Charlie, thanks for the call. Senator
Sanders,
this is part of your progressive budget as well, to reduce wasteful spending at the Pentagon. Do you want to go through quickly what your actual targets would be?
Well, very briefly. Yeah, well, it's hard to come up with an exact number, but Charlie's point is in my view, quite correct. We are spending roughly about $600 billion a year on defense. Now, how much you spend on defense should reflect what's going on in the world. When we were combating and taking on the Soviet Union, which was a superpower with, a huge army and military force, you can understand the United States having this kind of huge budget. But right now, I think it is time, given the deficit that we face and given the incredibly unmet needs facing kids and seniors and working families. As you're aware, there was a $5 billion cut in food stamps, for example. So I think that within the Defense Department, we can make judicious cuts, leaving us a very strong military. And that is something that we should do. So I agree with Charlie's point.
Well,
and I should also tell you that within that budget, it's just not only waste. If you ask the Department of Defense today to do an audit of the Department of Defense, they are unable to do it because it is so complicated and so large.
On the defense cuts and on the Pentagon, it won't surprise you that there are several Vermonters who have been writing in this morning then questioning your support of the F-35 fighter jet and basing them in Burlington. Ashley says, you say the Pentagon's wasteful spending should be cut, not needed social programs. If that's your position, why are you supporting the continued investment of $1.5 trillion on the F-35s?
Okay, I'll tell you why. That's a very fair question. Because the answer is, in a sense, that's a done deed. If we had this argument 20 years ago, whenever the process began about funding the F-35, it would be a valid and good discussion. Clearly, there has been cost overruns in the F-35, as well as many other weapon systems. That's one of the great crises and serious problems facing the Department of Defense. They keep telling us that a certain project is going to cost X dollars, and it ends up costing three times that. But in terms of the F-35, you have a plane, which is now the plane of the United States Air Force and the plane of other countries, including NATO. It is there. So the issue is not anymore whether you're going to do away with the F-35. It is there. It is the plane of record. The question is whether or not it comes to Burlington or whether it goes to South Carolina or whether it goes to Florida. And given the fact that the plane is going to be the plane of record, the plane of the military. I would rather see it in the state of Vermont, where we can maintain the mission of our Vermont National Guard, the jobs associated with that, the educational opportunities that go to members of the Vermont National Guard. So it's not a question, you know, we could sit down and have an argument about a new project. Is this a good idea to build this weapon system? That's a good debate. Is it too expensive? But when you have a fait accompli, and the only discussion now is if it doesn't come to Burlington, it's going to go to South Carolina, it's going to go to Florida. That's what the debate is about. Now, having said all of that, let me repeat what I am concerned about, and that is the noise issue. I think that is a very legitimate concern. And what I can say is that historically, the Vermont National Guard has been a good neighbor, and I have talked to them on this issue numerous times. And we have their word that they're going to do everything they can to work with the community to minimize the noise issue, which is a real issue. But in terms of whether that plane should go to Florida, South Carolina, or Vermont, I would prefer it go to Vermont and help our people and help our economy.
So looking then at sequestration and a second round of sequestration cuts that could come to us if there isn't a budget deal made or some other kind of deal to avoid sequestration cuts, we could see a Pentagon budget that actually winds up cutting some of the F-35 fighter jets that have been requested for 2014. Would you try to put those back into the Pentagon budget?
No, I wouldn't look at it that way. What we're talking about is a $20 billion across-the-board cut. I mean, the problem with sequestration, Jane, is it doesn't prioritize. It just cuts everything across the board. But again, I understand. Believe me, I do. I mean, we've heard from both sides on this issue. There is a lot of dispute in the state of Vermont. There are people who are strongly opposed to the presence of the F-35. There are people who are strongly for it. But the F-35, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but the F-35 is going to be the cutting-edge fighter jet for the military. It is here. And the question is whether it comes to Vermont or elsewhere.
Talking today with Senator Bernie Sanders, we're talking mostly about fiscal issues, budget issues that he is working on with a bipartisan and, in fact, dual chamber committee to try to find compromises to pass a budget before the end of this year. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. If you'd like to chat with him more, you can share your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Senator Sanders, on sequestration, some Republicans, including Senator Chuck Grassley of Iowa, who sits on the budget committee with you, argue that sequestration is actually working. Is there any truth to that, that it's actually working to cut the budget and doing some good things?
Well, I mean, how it all determines, it depends upon what you mean by the word working. Is it cutting the deficit? Yes. So if that's all you're worried about, yeah, Grassley has a valid point. On the other hand, if you're worried that kids being thrown off of the Head Start program at a time when we're already way behind in terms of early childhood education. No, it's not a good thing. If you are worried that people on the Meals on Wheels program, that is many Vermonters who, you know, are very older people who are frail, for whom a Meals on Wheels is the only good meal they may have in a day, and we're cutting that program, and we're cutting congregate meal programs, we're cutting the WIC program. No, I don't think that that's a good thing. So if you're only looking at cutting the deficit, you can argue that that sequestration works. But if you are concerned about a rational budget which protects working families and the elderly and the children, no, it is doing great harm, in my view.
How is a second round of cuts in sequestration going to look different? Because, for example, the WIC program that you just mentioned, the Women, Infants, and Children, because of some of the cuts in food costs, WIC has not had to kick people off of that benefit program. Is a second round of sequestration cuts going to look different to the American public?
Well, it obviously it depends on a number of factors. But in general, what we are worried about are programs in education. We're worried about programs in nutrition. We're worried about the Meals on Wheels program. We're worried about Head Start. So there are a lot of programs that will continue to be hit. I'm going to be meeting in a few hours with some Vermonters who are worried about affordable housing and the very significant cuts that have taken place in affordable housing. We're worried about, in general, above and beyond sequestration, the cuts that we have seen recently in food stamps. So the answer is it will continue to do, because it's strictly across the board and not prioritized a set of cuts, it will do damage to a lot of people who are already hurting quite badly in the current economy, including people who are receiving unemployment compensation.
Do you think there's a way to avoid a second round of sequestration cuts, even if this budget compromise that you're working on with this committee is not successful?
Probably not. I think the door, the opportunity to end sequestration is precisely the budget committee that we're working on right now.
Are you convinced? I asked you this earlier, and we talked about how you think at the 11th hour there may be a budget compromise. But I'd like to get a better sense of how confident you are that that will actually happen, that there will be a budget compromise reached by this committee or reached by some of the smaller conversations that are happening sort of outside, ex parte to the committee. Is there going to be a budget compromise? Because otherwise you're saying we are going to have the second round of sequestration.
Right. Well, if there is no budget compromise, we will have the second round of sequestration. And I think that that would be very unfortunate. Senator Grassley does not agree with me. But I think, by the way, a whole lot of senators, including many Republicans, do agree that just across-the-board cuts are stupid. In fact, there's one senator, Mark Warner of Virginia, often says, you know, they created this because it was so stupid and so absurd that nobody thought it would happen. And I think there are a lot of Republicans who share that view. So I think there is a goal to end this sequestration. Now, can I make a prediction to you? Honestly, Jane, I do not believe there's anybody in the world can give you an informed speculation about this. I think if you went to Patty Murray and if you went to Congressman Ryan, they could not give you an informed answer. We will see what happens. The good news is I think the Republicans do not want to shut down the government. I think that they do not want to put us in a position where we're not going to pay our bills and perhaps move toward a worldwide recession. And I think there is strong feeling that sequestration is not good public policy. That's what we have going for us. I think, as I mentioned earlier, there is an agreement that maintaining these very large loopholes for profitable corporations in this day and age does not make a whole lot of sense. And I would hope that that would be the area that people could come together around.
So last question, we're going to give it to Candace, who's a federal employee who had what she calls the, quote, pleasure of not receiving a paycheck this year during the government shutdown. Senators and congressmen don't experience that furlough in their paychecks. Would you, if we experience another federal shutdown at the beginning of next year? Would you take,
well,
would you say,
I put myself in the exact same position as my employees, and that I did not take the money until they got their checks.
That's Senator Bernie Sanders. Senator Sanders, thank you for talking fiscal issues in Washington with us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, how to reach Vermont's ambitious energy goals. That's 90% renewable sources by 2050. A new report gives us some policy options. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Vermont has some ambitious energy goals. We need to get to 90% of our energy from renewable sources by 2050, and we'd like to reduce our energy emissions to 75% below the 1990 levels. That's also by 2050. But how exactly we reach those goals, we haven't quite determined. Dr. Asa Hopkins has been trying to figure that out. He's the Director of Energy Policy and Planning for the Public Service Department. Last Thursday in Montpelier, he gave a presentation on the initial stages of the total energy study. Dr. Hopkins, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you, Janet. It's a pleasure to be here.
So the total energy study was mandated by the legislature when it set these goals in 2012, and you're working on creating some different scenarios that might help us get to them. But these, we should say, are policy scenarios. You're not saying we're going to need 57 wind developments and 15 solar farms. So what are you saying? What are the policy? What's a policy presentation?
Getting to these goals requires sort of two different ways of thinking. One is the technology pathway side of things, like you were just discussing, how much of what, how much wind, solar, biomass, hydro do we actually need? And the other side is, well, what policies would the government actually need to put in place in order to make that deployment actually happen, in order to get homes to be weatherized and the rest? So we're really looking at the second part of that. There's been a lot of analyses nationwide, globally, about, oh, you need so much of this and so much of that. But where the whole really is a menu of policy options for the legislature to actually evaluate and make decisions around.
You have five different scenarios that you've laid out for potential policy arenas that we could move into. And I'm going to ask you to sketch them all out, because you're not prioritizing them at this point. You're just trying to get different scenarios out there. The first one is nearly revenue neutral carbon shift. What does that mean?
Right. So this is basically taxing carbon, putting a price on greenhouse gas emissions in the context of tax reform. So in the context of cutting other taxes so that it would be revenue neutral or nearly revenue neutral for the state, but we could, for example, cut sales or income or property taxes and instead tax carbon to send better price signals to the economy as a whole.
I was looking at your PowerPoint presentation on this, and it looks like you were suggesting that among the tax cuts we could make would be taxes to gasoline and diesel, but wouldn't that be defeating the purpose?
I wasn't trying to suggest anything in particular, but one question when looking at the gas and diesel taxes that we have is whether taxing them to fund roads and taxing them to send the right price signal, whether we need to do both of those on top of each other, or if they could work in complement in some fashion.
So in other words, we could have a carbon tax on gas and diesel, but not a tax that then is saying, and this is going to help us to repair our roads.
Or rather that some of the revenue from the carbon tax might be earmarked and identified as the makeup for what would have been the gas and diesel tax and go to fund transportation.
And the idea here is tax the bad, don't tax the good in this plan, right?
Right. So if we want people to have more economic activity, more income, perhaps lower taxes on sales and income would be a good thing. And if we want less carbon emissions, maybe we should put the taxes on those emissions.
So that's one policy scenario. What about the second one down, clean total energy standard?
So that first policy is really focused on the greenhouse gas side. The second here is really focused on the renewable energy side and counting up towards 90% on renewable energy. So the basic idea would be that you would say anybody in the state who sells energy, whether they're a utility or a fuel dealer or a gas station distributor of fuel, has an obligation to make some fraction of their sales be either renewable or accounted for by energy efficiency. And the requirements could ramp up over time so that we got, by 2050, to 90% renewable. The different folks within that might be that I'm a weatherization contractor and I can get credits for doing home weatherization, and then I sell those credits to a gas station owner who has to retire them to show that they met their obligations. We have a tradable credit type system in that policy.
Okay, so how is that different than renewable targets with carbon revenue, which is the third policy
goal?
Right.
So the third policy piece is basically it's a cross between the first two with a little twist. So the idea for the third one is
to have those renewable energy mandates not be mandates but be voluntary, with a trigger that if they're not being met, then we'll step in and either make them mandatory or put a carbon price in. But in that voluntary context, it may be more important to have a little bit of revenue to spend to try to make that actually work really well. And in that case, it makes sense to raise that revenue, we think, at least for analysis purposes, on carbon. Obviously, I think a much lower carbon tax than in the nearly revenue neutral piece, just to raise a little bit of money you need to help make the voluntary renewable targets actually work.
These policy priorities that we've just talked about, these agendas that were laid out, are sort of overarching policy on carbon and on greenhouse gases. But then you go, the fourth one is sector-specific policies.
Right. So there the idea is, rather than looking across the whole economy as one giant program to rule them all, instead saying, well, you know, transportation is pretty different from home heating, which is pretty different from electricity, and maybe we actually just need totally different policies that work best for each one.
And then the last policy that you lay out is called regional policy focus, and this goes a little bit beyond Vermont.
Right. So here the idea is to look probably in that sector-specific manner again, but to recognize that we have a regional electric grid, our oil and propane and gasoline comes from other states. We have a regional market. People go back and forth across state lines. And so having a policy structure that's common between Vermont and the rest of New England or even New York might make sense and be more effective than just Vermont acting alone.
Is that something that's that we can get to? I mean, we certainly can't do that on our own.
Right. So one of the things we have to think about when evaluating these policies is, well, which of them is most likely to be enacted and effective on appropriate timescales? And so obviously one of the barriers you just highlighted there to this renewable one is getting six or seven states to act in concert, maybe slower than one state acting alone.
What criteria did you use to come up with these different policy scenarios?
So we have a whole set, but one of them, for example, is the question of, rather than saying that these are the criteria used to come up with the scenarios, when we look at these five and we try to decide where the pros and cons are, the criteria we're going to use to evaluate them include things like cost allocation. A certain amount of renewables or efficiency is going to cost a certain amount of money, and the benefits are going to flow back perhaps to different people than paid the money up front. And so different policies are going to impact how the money might flow. And so we're trying to track that as we go. And also looking at things like the robustness of policies. What if something changes? What if the feds change their policies? What if a new technology, pops up, dramatic cost decreases, or the price of global oil goes through the roof? How flexible are the policies that we're looking at, and are they going to be able to adapt to changing circumstances over the course of the 30-odd years until we hopefully hit our targets?
Well, given that you are looking at some of the ways to evaluate these policy plans that you've put out there, do you have a sense of which one might work best? Because we're going to have to choose one of them or some combination of a couple of them.
So I think it's a little early to tell. We're still doing the evaluation. I think different folks are going to have different opinions about which of the criteria are most important. We're hoping to do a narrowing down and do a real detailed quantitative analysis of three particular scenarios, taking the policy side and the technology side and putting them together into three packages over the course of the spring. And then we'll have final results of that analysis next summer.
How does having a policy scenario help us actually get to that next step that I mentioned at the beginning of when we started talking, figuring out exactly what the plan is in terms of what our sources are? For example, currently our transportation sector is 95% coming from non-renewable resources, 5% achieved with renewable sources. So if we were to, say, go with a nearly revenue-neutral carbon shift, or the regional policy focus that includes other states, that still doesn't get gas guzzlers off the road and drivers into biodiesel or hybrid cars.
Right. So the trick is to figure out which of those policies might be the most effective and try to inform the legislature, inform other stakeholders in the state, so that we can narrow the conversation and have a more concrete conversation about what the actual concrete steps we actually need to take will actually be, instead of thinking too much head in the clouds, well, we have so many options. Let's narrow it down and get ourselves a shorter menu to work from.
So you've released this draft report of the Total Energy Study for some public comments. It's going to be ready for the legislature in mid-December. And then in the spring, you're going to be working on deeper policy evaluation and initiatives.
Correct. Yeah, so we'll have the legislative report coming out December 15th. We'll have very much hope that folks who are listening will read that report, send us comments by mid-January so that we can incorporate those in to our later analysis, and then we'll have a next report, a final report for this process next summer.
Dr. Asa Hopkins is Director of Energy Policy and Planning for the Public Service Department. Last Thursday in Montpelier, he gave a presentation on the initial stages of the Total Energy Study commissioned by the legislature. Thanks so much for speaking with us today.
Of course. Thanks.
And that will do it for the show. Tomorrow, it's been 4 months since the train derailment in Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, led to an explosion that ripped through the town center. With the prospect of more crude oil being shipped by rail, safety has become a major issue. We're going to look at emergency measures that have been put into place and possible future safety steps for rail freight. And you can send your questions on rail safety to vermontedition@vpr.net and tune in tomorrow at noon. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.